Hello and welcome to the Inform podcast. This is episode number 41. My name is Neil and I am joined as always by the cat's meow of the podcasting world. Say hello, Jared.
Hey, how's it going, Neil?
It's going all right. So before we hit record today, you and I have been talking about a bunch of different things. One of the things that we've been talking about is wanting to keep things fresh on the Inform podcast, not get too formulaic, not get too boring, not do the same things over and over again. And we talked about trying out sort of a new format, a three-act structure kind of a thing, where we were going to have three different things that we are going to try on this podcast and probably for several in the future. We're going to see how it works out. Those of you who are listening, let us know what you think of the new format. If you have strong thoughts, opinions, criticisms, concerns, whatever, just let us know. So the first segment that we're going to jump into is called The Psychoanalysis of Everyday Life, which is a riff on the book by Freud, The Psychopathology of Everyday Life. And in this segment, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about something that's happened in our regular everyday lives, surprise, that has something to do with psychoanalysis, that makes us think of psychoanalysis, or there, maybe there was a psychoanalytic thing that happened or something like that. And we're going to alternate here. So this week, Jared, you're going to be the one to get us started with this segment. What do you have to report on from the psychoanalysis of everyday life?
All right. So I'm a little bit wary of putting this out there, but I'm going to do it anyway. It's going to be fun. It's going to, the only one that's got anything at stake is me. So I was at the clinic today in my office, and I was reading a book, one of the psychoanalytical notebooks. We're reading The Paradigms of Jouissance for something, and that paper is in this psychoanalytical notebook. So I was reading it when I had the time, and then I set it down on the desk. I had other things to do. I went and took care of those, and then I came back, and I didn't have time to read again. So as I'm packing up to leave for the day, I look at the book, I see it on my desk, and I think, I've got to stick that in my bag. I want to bring it home. I'm not going to be back here for a couple days. And then I turn to put my coat on and do all this other stuff. And then I leave my office, I get in the car, I start driving home, and I realize I left the book. I left the book on the desk. I told myself that I needed to get the book, and I left it there anyway. So, you know, why did I leave it there? I've only been thinking about this for like 15 minutes since Neil introduced this idea pre-recording. And I think that part of it is that, so I've been asked to sort of talk through, I guess, the first paradigm. It's sort of split. It's called the six paradigms of Jouissance, right? So it's split into these six sections. And so I was asked to talk through one of the sections. And so as I was reading, I was taking some sort of light notes on what I wanted to say as I went through it. And it's hard. It's a really difficult text. It's extremely dense. It goes through a lot of Lacan's other works. And Mallare is already sort of a hard read anyway. He's got a sort of idiosyncratic style. It's difficult. And I think that at least part of the reason that I left it behind was because then I wouldn't have the opportunity to write something that was wrong about this text. Mm. I wouldn't have the opportunity to mess up, to write something that totally misinterpreted the text. I think that's what was happening, because as I was reading and writing my notes, I thought to myself, like, man, I don't know if I've understood. I don't know if I've interpreted this the right way, air quotes, the right way, or whatever. This was all running through my head as I'm reading and writing these notes. And then lo and behold, I leave the book behind. Now I can't misread it. Now I can't misunderstand it or interpret it incorrectly, because it's not here.
Oh, that is a really good one. I like that you started with that, because it's such an interesting parapraxis, you know, to use a Freudian term there, right? I don't know how many people who are listening to this might be familiar with that term. I remember when I first kind of like actually got into psychoanalysis in a serious way, it was one of the sort of concepts that I was introduced to really early on, because, you know, my serious introduction to psychoanalysis was when I started my doctoral studies. And we had to read the introductory lectures to psychoanalysis. That was like the first text that we dived into. And that text starts off with these things called parapraxis. And parapraxies are these kind of like, I'll call them seemingly innocent mistakes that people make, errors that we commit. And usually we'll just kind of like write them off as like, oh, that I just, you know, was being absent-minded. I wasn't thinking, blah, blah, blah. But Freud's kind of hypothesis is that those things are in fact very telling, that they reveal something about an unconscious desire that we have. And, you know, just to kind of, again, bit of a reminder here, at this time in particular, the way that Freud is thinking about unconscious desires is that they're things that we want, but they get repressed into the unconscious. The unconscious is this sort of like place, I guess, where all of these things that you want, but you can't know that you want them, that's where they go. That's where they get kind of exiled or pushed to.
Right. They're unacceptable for one reason or another.
Right.
Whatever it may be. Yeah.
Yeah. And the weird thing is again, when Freud thinks that something is repressed, it's not destroyed. It's still alive. It's still active. It still has an effect on you, or, you know, whoever you are. It influences the way that you behave in your life. And, you know, Freud was also like really interested when people repeat these things. You know, when there was like a repeated, very similar kind of mistake, like being late all the time would be a good example of that, that I think a lot of people can relate to. If you're always like late to work, that says something maybe about, you know, your job, I guess, perhaps, versus if you're like late one time because there's like this terrible pile up and, you know, it was awful. There was cows that were on fire on the expressway or something like that. And so you were really late to work. That's not what he's talking about. That wouldn't be a parapraxis, because Freud is pretty clear in saying that there are times where accidents just do happen and you can be like kind of like a victim of happenstance, that of course.
Right.
But what he was getting at is that, yeah, we betray ourselves usually in very interesting ways. And it's not usually like by stabbing ourselves in the eye with a steak knife or something. It's like, the little things like what you just mentioned, right? Like you can't find your keys and you're like, oh my gosh, where are my keys? I always put my keys in this place. Like every day I put my keys here. And today when I have to go to my wife's friend's wedding that I don't want to go to, but I can't admit that, like, I can't find my keys. Where are my keys? Like that would be a good example of a parapraxis.
Right.
Yeah. It's interesting.
You know what else is interesting about his book? First of all, if you haven't already, you should read it. It's fascinating. Either the introductory lectures or the actual book itself, Psychopathology of Everyday Life. They're both really fun.
Yeah.
But something that's interesting in the book, The Psychopathology of Everyday Life, that seems evident, but I hadn't really thought about until I read it again in there, is that when you point this out to people, they don't usually like it. They would usually much prefer that it remain an accident, like a stumble or a secret or something. A lot of times people do not want you to point it out.
Absolutely. Yeah. That was the thing that Freud would interpret these, right? Like he would say like, oh, there's something else going on here. And people be like, no, come on. You don't believe that. It was a simple mistake. No big deal. Nothing to see here. And he'd be like, oh no, there's definitely something to see here. Yeah, for sure. That's really cool. That's a good one. I like that a lot. It gets me thinking too, like you mentioned, you know, that kind of paired that text with The Psychopathology of Everyday Life. So there's the introductory lectures of psychoanalysis, which is something that is, and it's kind of like at the very end, I think, of the early work of Freud. And The Psychopathology of Everyday Life is also kind of like in that early period.
Yeah.
When he's really interested in like the unconscious, the preconscious, and the conscious. This is pre-id, ego, superego, the structural model.
Yes.
For people who are, I guess, keeping track of things. And this relates to the six paradigms of jouissance, or at least it's an attempt to relate these two things. We'll see if I can pull this off. So having read the six paradigms of jouissance more than one time and agreeing with you that there's a lot there. I mean, there's so much packed into that text, and it's a text that I think you can return to a lot and always probably find something new and interesting and useful in it, no matter how familiar you might be with that text. What Mallaire does in there is he takes this idea of Lacan's jouissance, and he's saying that Lacan does not talk about jouissance in the same way throughout like his 30 some years of teaching. He changes the way that he talks about jouissance. And this is something that happens a lot in the Lacanian world. Like for people who kind of get deep into that, one of the things that you'll probably end up doing at some point is taking a concept and trying to do sort of like a genealogy of the concept, trying to see The different ways Lacan talks about it, say like in the 19, like you can go, I guess, as far back as the 30s, not everything will be there, but, you know, you could take something and say like, okay, so jouissance, he talks about it like this kind of early on, then he shifts to this, then he shifts to this, and Miller goes through six different shifts. Sometimes people will call these moments. They'll say there are these six moments right. in Lacan's teaching where he talks about jouissance. So like, and I don't have the text in front of me, so I'm doing this from memory. Like he talks about the way that Lacan, in one of the paradigms, he talks about how Lacan gets into it in seminar 7, where it's like the jouissance mm-hmm. of transgression and things. And he says it, and then he changes it when he gets into seminar 11 and goes on and on and on and talks about mm-hmm. these different moments. You can do the same thing with Freud, I think. And the way that Freud is thinking about the unconscious at the time of the introductory lectures and the psychopathology of everyday life, that to me is actually the most interesting way that Freud ever thinks about the unconscious, in my opinion, right? Like I, the other stuff is cool too, but that stuff is just, I don't know. There's something really revolutionary about it. It's new.
Yeah.
Right. It's like those first couple Beatles albums. When I mean the other Beatles is good. I love Revolver, right? It's a great album, but you know, A Hard Day's Night is just like, for what they did, it's like, wow, look what you're doing. You're doing this incredibly cool new thing. It's awesome. It's so experimental and new and stuff. So anyways, that's just what I was thinking about that. And do you have any thoughts about that at all?
Yeah, no, I mean, those big three books, Dreams, Jokes, and Psychopathology of Everyday Life. Those are really, really big. Those are some particularly interesting work. I mean, I've read his earlier stuff, his later stuff, whatever, but that really big, those huge books that sort of changed everything and went through, you know, revisions over the next 20 years where he added other thoughts. Those are great. Those are so great. They changed a lot of different things.
You know, what I think is so cool about those books is that what he's getting at there is kind of like what this segment is about, or what we hope it will be about, is it's this normal, almost mundane stuff that like pretty much everybody has experienced, right? Everybody has dreams. Everybody has weird dreams. Everybody forgets stuff. Everybody has an experience where they are seeing somebody and they can't remember their name. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I know who, and you have to like do the thing that you do where you try to like, you know, stall while you try to remember, and then perhaps eventually just own up to it and be like, I'm really sorry, I can't remember your name. Mm-hmm. You know, and Freud thought that those instances are so much more informative about what it is that goes on in our inner worlds than these kind of like grand narratives that we construct about ourselves. You know, the story that we want to tell ourselves and others about ourselves. He thought those were totally misleading, and more maybe representative of what we would like to be true than what is actually true. And if you wanted to learn what was actually true about a person, you'd pay attention to sort of like, I don't know, the receipts in their pockets, you know, the stuff that they don't think is important. That's the important stuff. The notes in the margins of their books, like that's where you can learn.
Right.
What kind of person this person is.
Yeah, no, I like that. Maybe this is too much of a digression. I don't know. But I like that notes in the margin thing. It's like, you know, anybody can put a book on their shelf, but it's what they write in it that sort of tells you something about it, or whether they write in it at all, maybe too. It's just a metaphor, but you know, I like it. It was a good one.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's really great. Because how often do you see that, right? Like, I don't know. This is the kind of voyeur that I am. When I go into somebody's houses, or, you know, I do like to see what books they have. And, if I'm bold, I'll look at this, you know, if I can see, it's like what looks to be like a worn book. Right. And I'll try to like voyeur, look at their notes. I ask, I don't just do it without asking. I think that would be a violation of someone's privacy, but if they give me permission, I'm like, oh, cool, you know. But I guess, like, as I say that now, that seems a little manipulative. Are they actually going to say no? I don't know. Whatever. Here's a funny story about that once. I was at somebody's house, and they happened to have a copy of 1984, the George Orwell book, mm-hmm. next to a copy of Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand. And I was like, yeah, you're laughing, right? That was that, my reaction was like, this is an in, like clearly not alphabetical, right? What's going on here? And the person said, oh, they both hated the government. And I thought that that was a great response to their ordering. I'm like, oh, so you have a section of books for people who hate the government. Got it. Interesting.
Yeah, I wonder who else would be in that section. That's pretty funny. I like that that grouping. I'm going to ask if they can do that at my library the next time I'm there.
That would be an interesting section. People who hate the government. Who would you put there? Yeah. All right, cool. Well, I think that, that was fun. That was a fun thing to talk about. Thanks for offering up the anecdote that you did. Let's transition into our main segment here.
Sounds good.
All right, Jared, so what is our main segment topic today? What is the main thing that we want to talk about?
We want to return back to analysts versus clinicians. I think, you know, you and I both still have a whole bunch of stuff to say about it. We could probably do more than just this episode as well, but either way, we're going to see what else we get through today.
Yeah, I mean, we've been talking about analysts. What is it that makes an analyst, you know, versus what is it that makes a clinician? We've talked a lot about the formation of a clinician versus the formation of an analyst. We've had numerous discussions about this amongst you and I since we talked about this. I think we did this on episode like 38 or 39. I can't remember exactly which one, but it's been this thing that has been kind of like haunting our conversations, I think, where we've been like, yeah, that's such an interesting thing. And it will probably continue, I think, to haunt at least my thinking for a while now. It's a really interesting topic. But why don't you get us started? What have you been thinking about in regards to analysts versus clinicians?
So something that's been on my mind is, I don't know a better way to put it, so I'm just going to call it like the organization of patients between a clinician and an analyst. What does that mean? Because it sounds like nonsense to me when I say it. What I mean when I say that is that I think an analyst is willing to be patient and willing to be impatient in different ways than what a clinician is willing to do. I think an analyst is willing to be patient in the sense that, you know, you're prepared for an analysis to take a long time. You're prepared for it to take a long time to be able to free associate. You're prepared for it to be a long time to wade through an analysand's demands. These are all things that you're willing to wait to happen. And you're willing to, the idea of an analysis taking several years is on the table from the outset as a direct result of it being an analysis and not something else. What an analyst is not willing to be patient with, what they need to be impatient with in the way that I think about it, is these formations of the unconscious that do happen during an analysis. We were talking about slips before. Our parapraxis is the word that we use. These slips of the tongue, these bungled actions, these forgetting books on a desk. These are all things that, you know, an analyst, when their ears are perked up, they would like to turn their analysand's head back towards. Rather than turning away from them, they would like their analysand to pay attention to this thing. Anytime the unconscious comes up, I think an analyst would like to direct their analysand's attention to it rather than letting it go by. I mean, sometimes it probably happens by accident. I'm sure you miss things. I know I have. I've missed things that later I thought to myself like, oh, you know what? That was probably something, but it went past me. But either way, when you do notice them, I think that what you want to do is draw your attention to them immediately and not wait until later. You know, there might be some flexibility in there, but I think that in general, this holds true. And I think that the organization of patients for a clinician is something that's different. I don't think that a clinician necessarily wants or is expecting, I guess, a treatment to go for, you know, after a certain length of time. I've heard of some clinicians that will see their patients for a couple of years, but it's not as common as what I hear analysts seeing their own analysands for. So I don't, not that a clinician is necessarily impatient, but this idea of it taking a very long time is not necessarily on the table in the same way that it is for an analyst. So I don't know. I just said a whole bunch of stuff. You tell me what's on your mind, Neil.
Yeah, so there's a number of things that stand out in what you said that I think are really interesting and really important. So the first thing is when you were talking about patients and you were saying like inpatient, I was imagining like inpatient clinics versus like outpatient. Like there was this, I was like, wait a minute, did I track that right? But I get what you mean. You're talking about the willingness to kind of like wait versus mm-hmm. the sort of injunction to make things happen.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly.
And so I would agree with you to start with, right? Like having, you know, started my career more than 15 years ago as somebody who was working as a clinician who didn't know anything I knew the stuff that a normal person knows about psychoanalysis. I knew there was this guy, his name was Freud. He liked cigars, blah, blah, blah. I knew that kind of stuff, but I wasn't into it. And I worked as a clinician only for a long time. And when I was a clinician, I think that the kind of work that I was doing was predicated on the assumption that it is my responsibility to make things happen and to make them happen usually relatively quickly, right? Yes. Somebody has come to me for help, or they've been sent to me for help by somebody else, like a court or something like that, perhaps. It is my job to rather quickly figure out what it is that is wrong with them, place a label on that thing, create a plan, you know, that will help them be more well-adjusted, I guess, to their life and to society and so on and so forth. And like make that plan occur, like put it into action, make it happen. Like the idea was to produce, I'm using my fingers in air quote motion here, improvement, and do so very quickly. And then also to kind of like demonstrate that. I think that's another thing that clinicians feel usually pretty compelled to do, I think, is that they're supposed to like prove, show, demonstrate that their interventions, their treatment, whatever it is that they're doing, that it's having some kind of a effect that fixes people, cures people, and makes people behave differently, mm-hmm. right? Versus when you're in analysis, there's this idea that, you know, if you're doing analysis, you're not doing psychotherapy, you're doing psychoanalysis. This is going to be a really slow cook, right? It's not, it's something which is going to have to, there's really no way to predict how long or how short it's going to go. Things will happen as they happen, and it will take a really long time, you know, for things to, I guess, like really happen in what I might call a significant way. And there isn't this sort of like demand to make them happen like in 5 sessions or 10 sessions or whatever sessions. It's just like, yeah, you know, you'll the person will show up and they'll say things. I'll listen. Sometimes I'll say stuff back and things will happen as they happen. It's much more open-ended that way.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, is that kind of what am I tracking what you were getting at correctly, or were you thinking
about
it differently?
Yeah, that's more or less exactly what I was thinking, you know, and everything that you said, makes me think about sort of like how you measure a good treatment, I guess, right? Like in certain forms of psychotherapy, you know, you measure a treatment with like, I don't know, a depression scale, right? You come in and at first you are this level that like I rated my depression on a 7. And then after your treatment, you want to see that number go down, right? And that's supposed to be your objective measurement of the you've proven that you did something during the treatment. And, you know, that's just not there. I remember using this in analysis, I should say. That's not there in analysis. I remember using this as an example in a conversation with someone else. If someone were to come into treatment and they said, you know, I want to stop smoking, that's what they say they come in for. And, you know, over the course of an analysis, they might very well come to the decision that rather than not doing that anymore, they're going to change their relationship with it in some way. Like I don't know exactly what this might look like, but, you know, like, I'm not going to be so tied to this idea of being a person who doesn't smoke or something like that. I don't know if that's a great example, but it's the only one that's coming to mind. And, you know, if that were to happen in most other kinds of psychotherapy that I can think of, you would count that as a failed treatment. Your goal was to stop smoking and you did not reach that goal. So I think you would probably classify that as some kind of failure, or at least you would have to reorganize your whole plan. Your whole treatment plan would be vastly different at the very least, if nothing else. And I don't know. I see that as being two different things.
I think that that's a really important point because, and again, this is a claim. I'm not going to be able to, like, you know, produce evidence or anything to this effect, but psychoanalysis, it seems to me, for the people it works for, it works in like when something happens, it sticks. When you talked about changing the relationship to something, right? Like, that's not a short-term project, but the results are also longer lasting, I would say. Mm-hmm. You know, you talked about quitting smoking here. So instead of just saying, like, okay, we have to do some sort of like behavioral thing that makes a person refrain from smoking cigarettes. Okay, you might, let's just say you could even do that for the sake of saying so, right? Like, the person stops smoking cigarettes. The question would be, what do they replace that with?
Right.
You know,
exactly.
And if you get people to stop smoking cigarettes, they might start smoking more marijuana, or they might, you know, start eating a lot more junk food or whatever. There's all any infinite number of things that they could replace that destructive habit with, that would possibly be more or less destructive depending on what they replaced it with. But the psychoanalytic idea might be described as trying to help the person sort of have a different way of relating to their own self-destructive desire.
Yeah.
Right? Like, why do you want to do these things that are self-destructive? You do want it. Right. I mean, we all have these, right? That's the other thing too. It's not like demonizing. It's not like saying you're a bad person because you have a desire to destroy yourself. I would say that psychoanalysis, you know, I'm speaking really broadly here, assumes that everybody has a desire to destroy themselves. And mm-hmm. that's the death drive. And that because if that's a repressed desire, it gets enacted in a bunch of kind of like weird, sort of like normal everyday things like smoking or eating lots of donuts or whatever, overworking, a combination of those, right? That's there for everybody. And it isn't like you're a bad person because you have this. This isn't just evidence that you are a regular person, that you have this. So rather than saying what you need to do is like get over that, i.e. not be a regular human being, it's saying like, no, you're always going to have a desire to do like these kind of like transgressive things that are somewhat self-destructive. How do you want to relate to that? What relationship would you like to have to that part of yourself? And it's an open question, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like, it doesn't assume that there's a kind of a funny thing that a lot of people, I think, who are engaged in psychoanalytic stuff will say, cure is always a byproduct.
Yeah.
You know, the way I understand that is that when somebody goes into psychoanalysis, they may end up being, you know, quote marks, cured of something, but it's usually not what they suspected they were going to be cured of. It's like something, it's a surprise. Right. And it comes from realizing something important about yourself and like your own relationship to different things that are like your death drive, your relationship to your desire to please people, your relationship to your desire to like be better than your sibling. Who knows what it would be? Right.
Right.
People have their stuff. And as you, I guess, achieve a greater degree of awareness about those things, and a greater degree of awareness about like kind of how they function, why they function the way that they do. Another way to say that is, you know, how do you go about kind of like wrecking yourself, and why do you want to wreck yourself? People start to get more of an understanding of that. I don't think they ever totally understand it, but they get a different understanding of it. And that changes things. And that kind of a change sticks around. So to your original point, what I think I'm trying to say here is that, yeah, it takes a long time to do that. You're not going to be able to do that like with a microwave. You're not going to do that at a drive-through window. you're going to have to, you know, spend a long time doing the prep work, you know, chopping up the food, getting all the ingredients, like just that, right? And then eventually you start the cooking process, and then, you know, later on, eventually you get to eat the meal, and that kind of meal is a lot more satisfying than, you know, getting a 6-piece McNuggets at a drive-thru window or something like that, or at least I assume that it is.
I like this food metaphor. You've used it before, and it makes me think of, so my grandmother used to make tamales, and tamales, if you don't know, take a very long time to make. It's not a couple of hours type thing. Like, you probably got to block out at least 2 days to make them. But when they're done, they're really good. So I've had tamales that were made by my grandma. I've had them that are made by other people as well. And I think what you're describing makes me think of the difference between like a well-done homemade tamale that took a couple days and a lot of time and energy and effort versus ones that you can buy at like a grocery store in a cellophane wrapped black container thing at like Jewel Osco or something. I've had those as well, and they are just not as good. They're just not.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like they can get the job done, right? But they're not going to give you the same kind of satisfaction. And I think that that's a good way to think about it. Like the difference between maybe like the sort of psychotherapy that a clinician provides. I don't want to, this is weird. Like, I feel like I'm kind of like doing a bit of a negation here because I am sort of smack talking this, but I want to sort of like take that down a notch or two, I think. So here's the way that I think about it. There's a time and place for psychotherapy. It can be really helpful to a lot of people. It has been helpful, I think, to me at different points in my own life. So I can say that, but, you know, I went through psychotherapy and got what I got from that. And what I've gotten from being an analysand, from going through psychoanalysis, is very different and has been a lot more satisfying to me, you know, than a lot of the stuff that I got through psychotherapy. But I guess I just want to make it clear that psychotherapy can be, and is often, useful. But the same way that if you're really hungry, yeah, you know, like eat the tamale from Jewel, you know, if you need to eat. But let's not pretend that that is the same thing as the kind of tamales that your grandmother makes, because they're not. It's just, they're different things. I mean, yeah, they're both tamales. Sure. Psychotherapy tries to be helpful to people. Psychoanalysis tries to be helpful to people, but it's just the whole process of each is very different.
Yeah. You know, I think I made a similar negation on one of our more recent episodes. And what we came to instead was like the fact that you and I are sort of slamming it right now doesn't change whether anybody has gotten something useful out of it before. Right.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, totally.
We can slam it all we want. But if you enjoyed your time and it did something useful and stuff like that, then fuck us, I guess. Right.
Like, yeah, totally. Like, what do we know? We're just two dudes doing a podcast, clearly, you know. And I guess that'd be really weird if somebody was listening to our podcast just to, like, you know, enjoy disagreeing with us. Wouldn't that'd be really a weird thing.
I would want to hear from that person.
I would too. I would love to. Yeah. I'd like want to hang out with them, I think. that'd be fun.
Totally.
there was another thing though that was in your original thing that I wanted to kind of come back to. And I think it's important. It's important to me anyways. I cannot tell you how many times I have heard from a clinician saying that they're going to pull the plug, put an end to, terminate a course of therapy because they say nothing is happening anymore. The person isn't getting anything out of it. And whenever I hear that, I ask the same question. What makes you say that? How do you know that they're not getting anything? And I mean that for real, like information seeking question, please. Like you might actually know that they're not getting anything. That could be real. But how do you know it? Like I really am curious. I want to understand how somebody could know that, because I never know that. I never know what people are getting out of the therapy. I can't, like, I mean, I could have them fill out like a survey or something like that. Like, how useful is therapy on a scale of 1 to 5? And people would do it. I don't think that would actually tell me what they're getting out of therapy or how useful the therapy is. I think it would just be them sort of like circling a number based on probably largely their mood and if they liked me or not. You know, that's right. What I'd be getting out of that. So I'm always like really interested and kind of baffled when people say nothing, they're not getting anything out of it. And so I asked that question. And what I've come to realize, I mean, people have different ways of answering that. That might be a different topic for a different day. But you don't hear psychoanalysts say that. I can't think of any instance in which I have ever heard somebody who, you know, practices as a psychoanalyst say, I don't think that this analysand or this patient or whatever word they want to use isn't getting anything out of this. They, I would argue, tend to assume that if the person comes back, they're getting something out of it. You could even ask the analysand, what is it that you're getting out of this? But again, a psychoanalyst wouldn't ask that question because they probably believe that even if you ask that question in a very point blank, kind of clear way, the person couldn't tell you what that is, right? It would be one of those things that escapes their capacity to signify it, to speak about it. They could speak about it a little, maybe some people could speak about it more than others, but they're, I guess like there's always going to be a remainder here. There's always going to be something left over that you can't quite articulate. You can't quite put into words. And that's why you're coming back, right? You come because there's still something happening. And maybe that's what you're talking about, you know, this willingness to wait, this being patient, like that's it. Yeah. I mean, you know, the person will vote with their feet. They'll come back if there's something valuable happening here for them. And if there isn't anything valuable happening for them, they'll probably stop coming, or they'll just, maybe they'll tell me that they're going to stop coming. Maybe they won't, but they won't come anymore. Right. They'll, they'll disappear. And that'll tell me that for whatever reason, this, they didn't want to do this anymore. And so they don't have to, you know, and that's okay. Versus the psychotherapist, the clinician, maybe doesn't see it that same way. Anyways, what are your thoughts on that?
I completely agree with you. It seems like a question that has an answer that's like right there. If they weren't getting anything out of it, they wouldn't keep coming, right? They're paying with money and with time. And why, I don't see why somebody would pay the money and the time if they weren't getting anything in return. I think you could probably make an argument that they feel some sort of compulsion to come, like, you know, I don't want to disappoint my therapist, so I'm just going to keep going anyway. But I think even that, if it is the case, is interesting on the face of it, right? Like that's right there. There's nothing, like there's more to say. There's something else there. Why are we ignoring it?
Yeah, I mean, they're getting the feeling that they're doing the therapist a solid, right? That's right. That's what they're getting out of it. And that's analyzable, right? Like that's as you pointed out, an interesting thing. Let's talk about that.
Exactly. And so to pose this question, like, it's, I guess it's not even a question. It's more of a statement, like they're not getting anything out of it. It just seems like the answer is staring you right in the face. They're still coming here. They're still coming. I've heard that get said before in the different clinics that I've been at before with different therapists that I've interacted with. And it just seems... It seems self-evident to me. It seems crazy to me that that's even a thing people say in the first place. I don't know. Maybe I'm being a little bit of a mean person right now, but I don't know. It seems to be right there to me. I don't know.
So that's really interesting. And this is, I just want to leave it at that because I think that that's really good. Right. I mean, that, how do you know this? How do you know if people are getting anything out of it? People can hear in my voice that I'm sort of like irritated by that statement, I'm sure, but cause I am, I'm trying to be generous here. So here's another thing that I thought was interesting is a comparison I want to make. And, it's a weird one. I haven't thought a lot about this. I wrote it down on my little like piece of paper here as you were talking when you got started. And I was like, I don't know if I should even bring this up. It might be too weird, but sometimes that's the most fun stuff, right? So let's go there. So I'm thinking about how in a lot of like therapy work, right? Work you do as a clinician, you have a certain number of sessions authorized, right? Mm. And again, that this kind of goes back to that idea that, you know, by a certain number of sessions, like something should have happened, i.e. the person should have somehow improved, you know, gotten a little bit better or whatever as a result of the work that you're doing. So there's that on the one hand versus psychoanalysis, which is this very like, you know, it goes on as long as it needs to go on kind of a thing, right? So here's a weird comparison that I want to make. psychotherapy reminds me of like going on dates, right? Like it's like you go on a date with somebody and you have like a certain number of dates before something should happen. And if it doesn't, you're like, this is a problem. This is clearly not working. And you're like, I'm out of here. Or they're like, I'm out of here. Versus psychoanalysis, which I'm going to liken to more of like a committed relationship, you know, where it's like, yeah, that like there's something happening here. I don't know exactly what it is, you know, but I'm committing to it. And I know it's like a long-term thing that I'm committing to, and I'm interested in committing to it. You know, it's like you date psychotherapy, but you get, I guess, like into a committed relationship with psychoanalysis. So like I said, that was my weird comparison. I figured I would toss that out and see, you know, what thoughts or, I don't know, if you want to chastise me, whatever you want to say in response to that comparison.
No, I like it. It makes me think of, so I use the website Reddit for, you know, various stuff. But if you look through their all feed, sometimes this subreddit will come up that's called Tinder, and people will post pictures of conversations they've had with people on Tinder. And sometimes they're pretty funny. But so if you go into the comments, what you'll find a lot is people who are like sort of like analyzing this short little conversation that somebody had over text on Tinder. And it's weird. There's so many rules apparently to online dating, to finding people on Tinder. There's so many. It's like, you know, they didn't engage enough with your conversation. They engaged too much. They like, look at their profile picture that clearly means this about them, or look at that profile picture. It clearly means that. Another one that I see a lot is the rules are, rule one is be attractive, and rule two is don't be unattractive, and stuff like this. Like there's all these rules, and I don't know. I think it's related to what you were just saying, but it's what comes to mind as you say it all.
That's funny. I'm laughing at all the things you said because this just sounds hysterical to me. I've listened to patients, you know, talk about using Tinder, and it's really funny. Actually, a lot of times I mean, the patients that I have will sometimes really crack me up. You know, telling me about this. Sometimes, I mean, I teach university too, so sometimes I'll like overhear ear hustling on a conversation or something like that. And that can be really funny too. It's wild. I don't know. But I guess to stick to the topic at hand, or at least make an attempt to, psychotherapy has a lot of rules, right? Like associated with it, where psychoanalysis maybe has, does it have like a much more kind of like relaxed like guidelines as opposed to rules?
I think that's fair.
Yeah. Okay.
I think it's a fair way to put it. Yeah. It has a different relationship with rules, right? It thinks about them differently, I think, if nothing else.
Okay. That's cool. So here's another thing that kind of comes to mind as we're talking about this. It's a stylistic difference.
Hold on. Time out. Real quick. There was something else that came to mind that I wanted to say before we switch topics. So I apologize for cutting you off. But I think that once you introduce rules into a relationship, it stops being the same kind of thing. I think it really fundamentally changes everything about the relationship once you introduce too many rules or start enforcing them too strictly. I'm thinking of this example. I was watching Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and there's this episode where two characters are doing like a stakeout for several days. And in order to make it bearable, they start introducing all these rules. Like you can't pour this much butter on your pancakes or whatever when you make them in the morning. And before the episode starts, they're like really great friends and so on. And then they add in all these rules, and all these rules make their friendship harder and harder to maintain during this stakeout that they're doing. I don't know. I think there's something to it. You in a certain kind of a relationship, you don't necessarily expect anything out of the other person in the relationship, or you expect something different or something like that. And then once you add in all these rules, it stops being the same thing. It fundamentally changes the relationship between two people. So that was what I wanted to say. Sorry, I cut you off.
No, that's cool, actually. I like that a lot because I mean, I think it would be wrong to say that psychoanalysis has no rules. That would be ridiculous, actually. It has rules. I think it just tries to kind of have like minimal rules.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you got, obviously you got to show up to your session. To have a session, you got to show up. You know, you got to talk, you, in some way, right? Like, I mean, you, mm-hmm. You can talk and with more than just words, but yeah, you, and I don't know, like there's a structure to it without a doubt, but I don't think that of it as what, like some sort of like very elaborate kind of structure. I'm going to make a Jurassic Park reference. I love every opportunity I have to make a Jurassic Park reference. So in Jurassic Park, the character Ian Malcolm, played by Jeff Goldblum in the movie, you know, he has this, he's this like chaos mathematician guy. And one of the things that he talks about in both the book, I think, and the film is that if you create a system, the more parts that your system has, the more elaborate your system becomes, the more likely it is that that system will totally break down.
Mm.
Because if one part goes, it tends to have like a chain reaction effect, right? Where then like another one goes, and then like pretty soon, like everything's totally broke. And he very simple systems, you know, are, they tend to run more efficiently anyways and with less energy, and they don't break as often. And if they do, you just kind of like turn it off and turn it on again, and mm-hmm. you start it back up, and it works because it's simple, right? It's a simple mechanism that doesn't have all these crazy, tiny, intricate moving parts, right? So try to think of a different example of this. Okay, I don't know how many people still have these, right? But for a while, I'm sure a lot of people did. Printers, like printers that you use to print out documents in your house, right? Changing the ink cartridges in a print, like printers broke all the time. I used to be in tech support when I was in college. That was one of the ways I supported myself. I cannot, I mean, I would go so far as to say that somewhere between 70 to 80% of the tech support calls that I was taking care of were printers. Printers not working, printers not connecting, printers getting jammed. Because they have all these damn like parts. They're extremely complicated machines, right? You compare that to something like a USB drive, you plug it in, boom, right?
And that's it.
You know, those don't not work very often, right? It's a simple thing. So I don't know. That was my attempt to, I guess, respond to what you're bringing up here. That when you, we're talking about like mental health kinds of stuff, you can create all sorts of rules. You can create like a Rube Goldberg machine, you know, of fill out this form and this thing and come for this length of time on this day, you know, and then do these. You can do all that stuff, or you can do the psychoanalytic thing, which I think is a very simplistic structure. Show up, speak, pay, repeat, mm-hmm. you know, what do you talk about? Whatever you want. You know, how long should I talk about it? As long as you want. It's mm-hmm. it's much more open. It's simple. It's a thing you could, there's just not a lot to it if you look at it from the perspective of rules. There's a lot of other things that if you look at it from other ways, it's like, oh, wow, there's a lot there. But with rules, mm-hmm. not so much.
Right.
Huh. That's cool.
No, I think that's good. I think that's good. You can keep adding more and more rules, and maybe that does something. I don't know, but it's certainly different. It's certainly a different thing than what psychoanalysis is.
You know, so here's another thing that I think is really a cool difference between the two. I think this is like a difference of style. As I started to say before.
Mm-hmm.
So in psychotherapy, I think a lot of times what people are trying to do is they're trying to make something happen. Like they have an agenda, they have a plan, they have a goal, an objective, a treatment plan, something like that. And so like there's this idea that like this will lead to this will lead to this. Where in psychoanalysis, I don't think that that's necessarily the case. And one of the ways that you can see this, I think, is in the type of interventions that get deployed in psychotherapy versus in psychoanalysis. So like one of the really common interventions that I think gets deployed in psychotherapy by clinicians is psychoeducation. Like, you know, I will teach this person about whatever. But this is that one that creates a power dynamic. I think where like the clinician has a lot more power and knowledge and stuff like that than the patient does. So that's one thing which is going on, where I think in psychoanalysis, that's just not the way that it works. Like a different intervention that I think comes up in psychoanalysis is making note of things or highlighting things. And that's it, as opposed to like trying to educate people about them. And so I guess I wanted to say a little bit more about that. So when you're doing psychoanalysis, you know, somebody comes in, they're an analysand, they show up, they come into the office, or they join the Zoom call or whatever it is nowadays, and they attempt to speak. There's no agenda to what they say. It's say whatever comes to mind and try not to censor yourself too much. You know, do your best. And they do that. And at a certain point, something will be said, and it will be one of those things. It'll be like where we kind of started this podcast. It'll be a remark that maybe doesn't seem that significant. And that'll be something that maybe the analyst will be like, I wanted to point something out, or, you know, this is interesting. And then they'll say something, or I want to note something that you said here. So I'm totally making this up here as I say it. You know, imagine that somebody comes in and at the start of the session, they're talking about something like happening at their work. They have some sort of conflict with somebody at their work and they're complaining about it. This person sucks, blah, 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 blah. You know, and then you don't, the analyst might not respond to that. They kind of sit there, they're waiting. Then the person shifts and they're like, okay, another thing that's kind of going on in my life is this situation with my roommate. And they start talking about their situation with their roommate. And at this point, an analyst might say something like, hey, I want to point something out to you. You used, although these are very different situations and very different relationships, you used the same word like multiple times in both of these anecdotes, right? Mm-hmm. Like you used the word annoying or something like that. You've used that a lot here today. And that's it, right? You're just kind of like, you point out a thing that has happened and then you let the person respond to that. There is no, and I think that is significant because blah, blah, blah. It's just pointing it out. Trying to think of a different example here that might make that make more sense, which is a little less abstract than the one that I just made up. I can remember, this is not sometimes this happens in just like everyday life, right? But I can remember talking to a friend of mine kind of recently about having their kids do school through Zoom, which is a hard thing. And as they were talking about it, their whole body, like language became like somewhat like just like defeated, like their shoulders slumped and they just looked like even talking about it was exhausting. Right. Mm. And I said this is really interesting. Like we were talking about hockey and it was like, they looked a certain way. Like as soon as you started talking about Zoom school for your kids, which they're not doing in that conversation, they're just talking about it. Like their whole affect just like morphed, and it was just pointing that out, right? Like that's highlighting, that's noting, that's what you do here. I'm not going to educate the person on what their body language might mean or whatever, but I just want to point out that this thing just occurred, right. That was just like a regular conversation. That's, I think, kind of indicative of what you might see in a psychoanalytic session, right? Is just that you're just saying like, hey, notice this. Hey, what about that? Versus in a clinician psychotherapy session where it'd be like, you're doing this and you're doing it. And here's some of what the research might say about blah, blah, blah. You know, and you go into this like education, I'll teach you about it mode. I think it's very different. Right. I don't know. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah. I mean, you specifically use the word educate, psychoeducation, educate. I'm not going to educate them on this. And, you know, it calls to mind the discourses for me. You know, you might be, as a therapist, you could take up many different discourses during a session. And to educate immediately makes me think of the discourse of the university, right? Like, these are the things that I know, you will now learn them and use them to do something else with them, or use them to do this thing in a different way or whatever. I don't know if that's quite on the mark, but it's doing something different with the knowledge that you've accrued as a therapist, as an analyst, than what you would do in the discourse of the analyst, I think.
Yeah.
In the discourse of the analyst, the way that I think about it, and you've said this before, like you have this psychoeducation, you know about developmental theories and behavioral theories and all this stuff and object relations and whatever else. You have it all, but you don't necessarily lay it out on the table, mm-hmm. right? You don't say, these are the things that I know and this is what's going on. You keep that sort of hidden away, or maybe that's the wrong way to put it, but you know, you don't lay it quite so bare. You do something different with it.
Huh. Yeah, that's really interesting. What this makes me think of is, I kind of feel bad bringing this up at this moment because I don't know if we're going to have time to really dive into it, but maybe we can return to it in a future episode. I think of a clinician in psychotherapy as things that are more aligned with the big other, right? Than anything else, right? So like there's this big other, and the big other demands different things from people behaviorally and emotionally and so on and so forth. And clinicians and psychotherapists, I think, try to sort of like be an agent of that big other and to help the people who come to them maybe comply with those demands in a more effective way. I might be being too flippant here as I say that, but that's what I'm thinking right now. Versus psychoanalysis, which I think that the psychoanalyst tries to not be an agent of the big other, but instead tries to kind of enact the objet-a, the object cause of desire, mm-hmm. right? And that's a very different thing. If you were talking about the four discourses and, you know, in the analyst discourse, the objet-a is in the position of the agent. And I could say more about that, but that would be totally inside baseball. I don't know how many people have read Seminar 17. So what I'll do instead of going inside baseball speak here is try to speak a bit more generally about what it means to be objet-a as opposed to an agent of the big other. In my mind, to try to enact objet-a, what you're doing is you're trying to not tell people things. You're in a sense, if there's any kind of transference that has occurred in the relationship where the patient assumes that you know stuff because you're a fancy psychoanalyst, you have degrees, you have licenses, you've been doing this for however long, you must know things. And you do. But what you do is you're circumspect, right? You don't necessarily come out with what you know. And this keeps them guessing and it tries to kickstart what I think I've even maybe used this term on previous episodes of the podcast. It kickstarts the paranoid machinery of interpretation within the patient, mm-hmm. within the analysand. And it gets them to start going like, maybe I do that for this reason, or maybe part of what causes that is this thing from my past or something along those lines, right? They want to know what you think. And since you don't say it, they become more interested and they keep talking in an attempt to maybe get you to chime in, you know, and that can be really productive for a certain kind of person. It's not productive for everybody, but the people it works for, man, does it really work? It's so much more effective than telling them, here, do this, do this, do this, and then come back in a week and report to me on how that went. There's nothing mysterious about that second way. There's a lot of stuff mysterious about the former way.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. There's a gap that you want to maintain in psychoanalysis that I think in certain kinds of psychotherapy you want to close. You want there to be some sort of space between what is and what you would like to be, or something like that. Like between what is and what your desire is, you want there to be some space in there. You want there to be some thing, some lack, I think, and to try to fill that up makes it into a different thing than psychoanalysis.
Yeah, maybe it would be safe to say in a kind of simplistic summary here that psychotherapy is very interested in answers, producing answers. Here's the answer. Psychoanalysis is much more invested, much more interested in the production of a really good question that you don't have the answer to.
Yeah, no, I think that's perfect. I'm not going to say anything else.
All right, cool. We'll transition on that note.
All right, so we're back. Neil, at the beginning of this episode, you said that we're going to be splitting this up, trying out a sort of three-act type of thing here. And so this is going to be our third act. We're calling it Various Sundry Things. And in this section, we're just going to talk about something that might be related to psychoanalysis, might not be related to psychoanalysis, but something that we find interesting, something that we're watching or reading or doing or whatever. And so since I did the psychoanalysis of everyday life, Neil has graciously taken up the third act here, and he's going to tell us about some various sundry thing.
Right. And the idea here is that next time we do a podcast, we'll switch. I'll do the psychoanalysis of everyday life, and Jared will do the various sundry things. And just to kind of give credit where credit's due here, we're stealing this idea. This is this kind of like three-act structure is something that there's another podcast that we both listen to. So I guess I'm going to talk about two various sundry things. This is the first. The podcast we're stealing this idea from is a podcast called Owls at Dawn. And it's done by these two guys. Troy Palladori is one, and Austin Hayden Schmidt is the other. And it's a podcast that I really like. I enjoy it so much. So much. It's such a fun show. Their three-act structure is they start off with something they call the shitty minute, which is where they talk about something that's like making them mad. Then they do their main segment, which is usually about like philosophy in some way. Mm-hmm. And then their final thing is a sticky leaf, like something that's giving them hope in a universe that is so big that they might just be totally insignificant to it. Right. So that's sort of their three-act structure. And when Jared and I were talking about, you know, wanting to always like kind of keep the podcast fun for both of us, right? Like we were like, maybe we want to try that. And so we didn't want to steal their terms. And so we stole their idea and then renamed it in a different way, right? So instead of the shitty minute, we're talking about the psychoanalysis of everyday life, which oftentimes I don't think will be shitty. I think it'll be is kind of interesting. And then we're, instead of a sticky leaf, we're calling it a various sundry thing. So that's the first thing is if you don't listen to Owls at Dawn, I would encourage people to do it because it's just a really fun show. It's really, really good. It's cool. It's well-produced. The hosts are smart and funny people, so I would recommend that. But the thing that I was going to talk about, I didn't know I was going to talk about Owls at Dawn. That just kind of occurred to me. the thing that I had planned to talk about is a movie that I saw recently. You know, I have a small child, and when you have a small child, you don't have a lot of time. And you know, I have my practice. I see patients. I teach. And this semester has been like totally bonkers because it's been so much new stuff. You know, remote learning. I was teaching two new classes that I had never taught before. It's been nuts. So I don't get a lot of chance to watch movies. And so what happens is like I put movies in a like Netflix queue, right? And I'm like, I want to watch that at some point. And one of the movies that's been in it wasn't a Netflix queue. This is my Amazon Prime queue. Was the movie Inside Llewyn Davis. It's a Coen Brothers movie. Have you seen this?
I have not.
Okay. So it came out I don't remember when it came out, but it came out and it's been years that this movie has been out at this point. And I've been wanting to watch it and wanting to watch it. And I finally got around to watching this movie. And it's really, really awesome. It's so good. I don't want to spoil anything about the movie plot-wise. Or even structurally, because the structure of the film is actually also very interesting, I think. The way that it kind of like lays everything out in the order it lays it out in is very interesting. So here's what I found so compelling about it, is how relatable I think this film is. And what makes it really relatable is I would describe the premise of the film as what it's like to be really good at something, but not exceptional.
Huh.
Which is, I think, something that
sounds really cool.
Yeah, it's something that I think everybody can relate to, right? So, I mean, the film is about this guy who's a folk singer. He's a musician, Llewyn Davis, and he's good. You know, he can play a guitar, he can sing a song, he can be entertaining on a stage, but he might not be great. You know, he might not, in a sense, have the whatever it is that like I don't know, certain like Joni Mitchell or Bob Dylan has, right? Like there's a thing that certain performers have that sets them apart from your talented person. You know, they're not just talented. They're talented and then some. This guy doesn't have the and then some. And
keep going.
I mean, that's my read of the film anyways. Other people might have different reads. That happens to be mine. So I feel like I could set it up that way. You know, like, and this is interesting, right? Because I think a lot of people have experienced this. I know I have, right? Like, I don't think that I'm like some sort of like a genius level IQ or something like that, because I'm not, you know, but I don't think I'm a dummy either. I think I'm good at things. I don't know that I'm really like incredible at anything though. And yeah, that can really not be easy, right? Like, because of course there's a desire to be like exceptional, to be great, to be amazing at something, but the likelihood of that occurring, you know, is rather slim. And coming to terms with that is a somewhat traumatic process, I think. And the way that this film kind of illustrates this is really, really interesting and very compelling to me. I watched it and it made me think of just people who I know in my regular everyday life. It made me think of patients that I have now and that I've had in the past, of just people who have a fantasy, you know, of made me think of myself, of being just like this really, oh my gosh, amazing, wow, like at whatever, but not having whatever it is that you need to have to be that, you know. I don't know. So I thought that was really interesting. And I mean, it was sad. I wouldn't say that the movie is like a feel good movie. I wouldn't say it's something that it's not a total like downer either. It's a Coen Brothers movie. It has their sense of humor, which is unique. And it's the kind of sense of humor that I like. And so I laughed very often when I was watching the film. It was like a tragic comedy, I think you could describe it as. And, but it was tragic and it was comic. And the way that it's all put together is just super good. So I would recommend that if you haven't watched Inside Llewyn Davis, give it a shot. I think if you have Amazon Prime, you can stream it for free. That's how I watched it. I don't know if there's any other ways you can watch it, but if you haven't seen it, I hope that you'll get a chance to sit down and watch it. I was really glad that I did. It was one of those things where when I watch a movie, like I said, I don't have time to do it very often. So like, if it's just sort of like, all right, then I get a little bit irritated sometimes because I'm like, oh, man, I used my little bit of time for that. But this was one of those times where I was like, I'm really glad I watched this. That was,
yeah,
that was solid. That was a good pick. So yeah, that's my various sundry thing for people to check out.
It sounds amazing. It sounds like the kind of thing that I would love to watch. I like those movies that don't sort of beat you over the head with like unrelenting positivity, you know?
Oh yeah, totally.
I think, yeah. Yeah. So that sounds like something that does not fall inside that category, which is my favorite kind of movie.
Mm-hmm. Some of the things that happen in it too, that are just like, there's things that I think it's a very relatable film. I will say that too. Like you'll see the guy like get angry at somebody and overreact to something. And then like, you know, later on need something from that person who he overreacted at. Like there, people go through these sorts of things. This isn't, and that's what was so great. I mean, there's some movies, like, I don't know if you watch a movie about, another movie that I want to watch. I haven't watched it yet, but I don't think it'll be very relatable, is the film Rush, which is about like a Formula One racer. I want to watch that because I think it'll be kind of interesting or something, but, I don't think it'll be super relatable. This film, even though I'm not a musician, like I could relate to it because of just like the things that happen. There is one scene that I can't remember the exact quote, but I just like, I laughed and laughed at this scene. I thought it was so funny. The main character has a sister and his sister has a kid. And at one point, like he gets into an argument with his sister in front of the kid. And he says something along the lines of like, to the kid, he's like, your uncle's just like a terrible person. He's an awful monster, you know? And the kid just like is eating cereal and looks up at him and goes, okay. And it just, I thought it was so funny. The delivery of that was incredible. It was so good. So I guess I spoiled that one thing, but there's a lot of other really funny moments in the film that you'll get a kick out of, I think.
That sounds awesome. I'm going to queue it up.
All right, cool. Well, this has been fun, Jared. Listeners, okay, here's the deal. How can they get in touch with us? I broke our website recently trying to do an update on something, so I'm going to try to fix that. If you go to theinform.org, there's information there you can use to get in touch with us. if you Google me, Neil Gorman, I'm sure you'll find all sorts of ways to get in touch with me. If you have thoughts, opinions, questions, criticisms, concerns, whatever, we would like to hear them. And good, bad, somewhere in between. That's cool. Thank you very much for listening. And we're going to sign off.